Bonjour and a very warm welcome to the Good Life France podcast. I'm Janine Marsh. I'm a writer and editor of the Good Life France magazine and website. I was born in London, but I now live in the middle of nowhere in Pas-de-Calais in rural northern France. I have a split life, writing and travelling around France for part of it, and then caring for a ton of animals the rest of the time. At the moment, we have four puppies, eight previously stray cats, one of which is very feral. We call him Rudolph Valentino as he's black and white, like a black and white film actor. Plus, I have chickens, ducks and geese. Occasionally, we take in sick animals as well. Like last year, we had a hedgehog over winter in the house and a dove with a broken wing lived on the windowsill for several months. It wasn't that much fun, actually. When I'm not writing, travelling, feeding, cleaning up after animals, I love to share this podcast with you alongside my podcast partner, Olivier Geoffrey.
And bonjour, salut, ça va, coucou, there always to say a great big hello in French to you all, and yes, indeed, a big welcome to this podcast in which we share with you everything you want to know about France and much more. And if there is something you want us to chat about, by the way, on the podcast, at the end of this episode, I'll give you some details of where to send your questions and requests for topics we love to hear from you. But for now, let's get chatting about today's topic. Janine, tell us more, please.
Well, it's something very special today. It's a world record breaker, an unusual and unique beauty. It's a towering icon that's as hard as iron. And I am, of course, talking about the Eiffel Tower in Paris.
Ah, the Iron Lady, or la Dame de Fer, as we French say. Oh, yes, she has so many stories to tell. The Good Life France podcast. Everything you want to know about France and more with Janine Marsh and Olivier Geoffrey.
The Eiffel Tower isn't just a symbol of Paris, it's a symbol of France. But it wasn't supposed to happen. The tower shouldn't even be there. But we have to go back to the beginning of the story to find out why she's even there in the first place. So, at the end of the 1700s, fairs began in France known as Expositions des Produits de l'Industrie Française, an exhibition of French industry and products, basically. These were fairs where you could buy products from all around the world, and they've been held in France and other countries since way back in the Middle Ages. It's quite normal to have these sorts of fairs, although less about industry. The fairs were held regularly in France until the mid-1800s, and then in 1851, a new type of fair was held in London called the Great Exhibition, and it was visited by around 6 million people, which is an astonishing number for those days, and it featured the famous Crystal Palace. However, after the mid-1800s, the fairs in France were held only on rare occasions because they just didn't make enough money. It wasn't worth their time to carry on. So, in 1878, after a horrible loss, they pretty much decided they were going to give up. But it wasn't much longer after that, in 1889, that they changed their mind and they decided to commemorate the anniversary of the French Revolution. And they were going to hold a huge exposition universelle, a universal exhibition, which was going to be held in Paris from May to November 1889. Now, this caused a big problem because several countries weren't happy to take part in something that celebrated cutting the heads off of kings and queens on account of them having royal families themselves. And for that reason, some countries officially boycotted taking part in the exhibition, including Great Britain. Though, funny enough, the British royals did go to the event as visitors, and some British exhibitors used private funding to have stands. Now, what's all this got to do with the Eiffel Tower, you might ask?
Well, the organizers of the Exposition Universelle drew up grand plans for a truly spectacular event. They needed to attract millions of visitors to their fair so as not to lose money, and they wanted to improve the French economy by showcasing the skills of French engineers, you know, designers, chefs, artists, and so on, everything and anything, as well as products from all around the world in one of the world's great cities, Paris, of course. Although it was about the centenary of the French Revolution, it was also very much for economic reasons. They hoped that French companies would find new customers. And the organizers wanted to showcase something so incredible that people wouldn't be able to resist seeing it from themselves. They needed what they called a clue, you know, a spike or a hook. Basically, they wanted a signature structure that would be seen as a symbol of French culture. A competition was announced in 1886 for an architectural design that would make the Paris Exposition irresistible. It required the entrance to submit a design for a tower that was 300 meters high. More than 700 designs were submitted to the committee.
700?
Yeah.
700 designs? That must have taken a while to judge.
Well, some of them were very easy to discount, actually. For instance, there was one which was a 300-meter-high watering can, which the designer said would be good for hot days. Yeah, of course. And there was another that was for a 300-meter guillotine.
Oh, no. No, that is proper creepy.
Yeah.
I don't think that would have had quite the same effect as the Eiffel Tower. Now, a tower for an exposition wasn't a new idea anyway. In Philadelphia, which had also held a centenary exposition in 1876, the tower proposition had been discussed, but it went nowhere. However, the idea was out there and known about. Some people even think that Gustave Eiffel must have suggested the idea to the Exposition Universal Committee in Paris himself. I mean, after all, he was a prominent businessman with a construction company that specialised in building metal bridges and railways, cranes and lifting equipment. So it's very possible. And some say that he had even begun working on the idea before the contest was even announced.
It was actually two of Eiffel's engineers who came up with the original concept of an iron tower. They sketched out the tall metal tower and Gustave bought the exclusive rights to the draft ideas and then developed the idea to completion.
On May the 12th, 1886, Eiffel's design was announced as the winner of the contest, of course. At first, he felt it was a bit of a no-win situation. The deal was that he had to provide most of the money to build it himself because the committee said they would only provide 1.5 million francs, which is less than a quarter of the overall cost. To sweeten the deal, they agreed that Eiffel would have the exclusive rights to keep all income for 20 years. Everything that came from the tower, all the profits, would go to him for 20 years. That included entry fees, operation of restaurants, viewing platforms, anything. Eiffel took a bit of a risk because he didn't know if it was going to be that successful, but ultimately it was a brilliant deal. He recuperated his entire input in less than a year, and the tower made him immensely wealthy.
But his design wasn't always popular. When the plans for the towering monument were published, many people complained, actually. Another committee was formed, this time composed of artists and celebrities in France. They called themselves the Community of 300, and they campaigned to have the tower cancelled. They wrote that it was, I quote, a ridiculous tall tower dominating Paris like a gigantic black factory smokestack crushing with its barbaric mass Notre-Dame, Sainte-Chapelle, the Tour Saint-Jacques, the Louvre, the Dome of Les Invalides, the Arc de Triomphe. All are humiliated monuments, all are dwarfed architecture, which will be annihilated by Eiffel's hideous fantasy. Wow. For 20 years, the overseas city of Paris, still vibrant with the genius of so many centuries, we shall see spreading out like a blot of ink the shadow of this disgusting column of Bolton tin.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Blimey, that's a bit harsh. Shadow of a disgusting column of bolted tin. Wow. But you know what? Eiffel had the last laugh. The tower was built. It took 2 years, 2 months and 5 days. 500 workers assembled 18,000 iron pieces and put them together with 2.5 million rivets. The building of the tower was completed on the 31st of March, 1889, although their lifts weren't complete for around another 2 months or so. At the end of it, Gustave raised a flag and announced.
I'm going to try to have a French accent because usually I don't, but I'm trying. So he announced, "I have just experienced a great satisfaction, that of having flown our national flag upon the tallest building man has ever built."
Oh, that's an excellent French accent.
Thank you.
Very good. So Eiffel's monument opened to the public 5 weeks later on the 15th of May. It formed the grand entrance to the fair, and it must have been a jaw-dropping sight. Right from the start, it was a towering success. Sorry about that pun. It opened to the public on 15th of May, 1889. But the lifts, as I said, weren't ready. They opened on May the 26th. And the first visitors were the British royal family, the ones that hadn't lost their heads, and William F. Cody, a.k.a. Buffalo Bill. Astonishing, isn't it? In the first week, nearly 30,000 people paid to climb to the viewing platform. And it wasn't cheap to get into the Paris Exposition. It cost 40 centimes, which doesn't sound very much, but except at that time, you could actually get a meal for 10 centimes. And to climb the Eiffel Tower, it cost a whopping 5 francs, which is a huge amount of money in those days. By day, people flocked to climb it. By night, they flocked to watch it glow. It was one of the first tall structures in the world to have passenger lifts, and the tourists absolutely loved them. They'd never seen anything like it. By the time the exposition was over, after 173 days, almost 2 million people had paid their 5 francs to climb Eiffel's Tower. The views from the top on the days before air travel, so it must have been really astonishing from them. So on a clear day, they could see 42 miles in every direction from the top. And I can't even imagine how they must have felt because, you know, there were no aeroplanes. There was nothing like this. There were no tall buildings like this. It must have been absolutely amazing. There were 4 restaurants on the first floor. Each one of them could seat up to 500 people, and they were constantly booked. You could even buy a little mini parachute or balloon and tie a message to toss it over the side. Eiffel made an absolute fortune.
I bet. And in September 1889, the famous inventor Thomas Edison visited the tower and wrote in the guest book,
"To Monsieur Eiffel, the engineer, the brave builder of so gigantic and original, a specimen of modern engineering, from one who has the greatest respect and admiration for all engineers, including the great engineer, the bon Dieu, Thomas Edison."
So yes, the fair itself was a resounding success. There were 61,722 official exhibitors, 25,000 of them from outside France, including from Argentina, Hawaii, Japan, New Zealand, and the US. The whole fair cost 41.5 million francs to put on, and they made a profit of 8 million francs. They were also left with an improved public transport system. Their reputation was enhanced, and they had all these amazing buildings created for the fair.
But the buildings were only supposed to be there for 20 years, and that included the tower. I mean, for us now, it's incredible to think that the authorities destroyed almost all of these incredible monuments created for this humongous exposition. There are very few left, the Petit Palais and the Grand Palais, which are both now museums, and they are extraordinarily wonderful. By the way, if you're ever in Paris and you want a relaxing cup of tea or coffee, the Petit Palais is free to enter and has the most gorgeous garden cafe. Anyway, Eiffel, clearly a very clever man, he proposed to the French military that the tower could host a radio transmitter, and they agreed. So when the 20 years was up, the tower was saved. It was the tallest man-made building in the world for the next 41 years until the Chrysler Building in New York took the title. Nowadays, the Eiffel Tower is 330 metres tall, not 300 metres tall like it was at the beginning, because that includes antennas. And the last one was put on top in 2022. It's more than 3 times the height of the Statue of Liberty.
And the tower weighs a whopping 10,100 tons.
Wow. The names of 72 French scientists, engineers, and mathematicians are permanently affixed to the side of the tower in 60 centimetre tall letters just beneath the first platform. You can see them quite clearly. There are 18 names on each side. These people were chosen for their discoveries and inventions, which Eiffel considered to have increased, quote, the frontiers of knowledge. And also, this is the truth, because none of them had names more than 12 letters long, which they had to have to fit into the space he had to place them. So unfortunately, if you were a very clever engineer, scientist, or mathematician, and your name was longer than 12 letters long, you didn't go up on that space.
Counting from the ground, there are 347 steps to the first level of the tower, 674 steps to the second level, and 1710 steps to the small platform on the top of the tower. Every year, there is a contest to run to the top, up 1,665 stairs. The fastest do it in 10 minutes. That's a very short amount of time.
10 minutes? Yeah. God, I think it would take me a heck of a lot longer, and you'd probably hear me coming because I'd be panting. It's a bit chest thumping, that climb.
Same here. But how about by bike then? Yes, I did say by bike. Yes, there is a man who holds a world record for climbing the tower by bike. He basically locks the brakes and hops up the stairs. The record is 19 minutes.
Oh, wow. There's no limit to imagination, is there, for some people?
And craziness.
Now, that wouldn't appeal to me, by the way. I wouldn't mind repainting the tower, though. I reckon that'd be really interesting. And that happens every 7 years. Gustav himself recommended this. When they do it, the old paint has to be scraped off, and then they have to put rust-proof paint, and then they paint over the top. So in the end, it works out to about 66 tons of paint to cover the 2.5 million square feet of this enormous structure. And it takes 50 painters up to 3 years to do it, because they can only work when the weather's right. So, if it's raining or windy, they can't go up there. And every time they paint it, it's a different colour. So once it was yellow, when it was first created, it was Venetian red. And the last paint job finished in November 2022, and it's called Yellow Brown, which was the same colour it was between 1907 and 1947. The colour is darker at the bottom. It gets lighter as they go up, and then it's three different shades, which creates an impression of uniformity.
Also, you may not know that, but the tower has had many different businesses installed. Le Figaro newspaper had an office and printing press on the second floor during the World Fair. On the first floor, there used to be a post office and a theatre.
Here's a strange fact. In 1925, the Eiffel Tower was almost sold by a con man by the name of Viktor Lustig from what is now the Czech Republic. He made a living selling boxes that printed $100 bills, or at least people thought they did. Actually, they were filled with counterfeit notes, which emerged very slowly. Apparently, it took about 6 hours to print each one. Apparently, people fell for it. Don't know how. Anyway, Victor read in a newspaper that the Eiffel Tower was getting a bit rusty and that the government were reluctant to deal with the cost of repairs. And he had this idea to try and sell it. And he was going to pretend to work on behalf of the government, who wanted to dismantle it, but wanted it to be kept confidential. So he had headed paper printed up with a fake company name. And he invited the bosses of five big salvage companies to the swanky Crillon Hotel in Paris. And he told them that they were the lucky ones. They'd been chosen to bid on this very important government project. He treated them to lunch. He had them driven to the tower, where he flashed a fake ID, and he gave them a tour. He even picked out a patsy, poor Monsieur Poisson, one of the bosses who was keen to bid but wanted guarantees. So Victor told Monsieur Poisson if he paid him a little bit in advance, he'd make sure that Poisson won the bid. And since bribes were fairly standard with government officials, I'm not going to make any comments there, Poisson agreed and handed over the bribe and the bid advance. Well, Victor scooted off to Vienna with a suitcase full of money. Mr. Poisson went with his bill of sale to ask when he might begin dismantling the tower and got laughed at. And he was so embarrassed that he kept quiet, and Victor got away with it.
But the problem is, Victor was greedy. He tried to sell it again. And he got caught, but he managed to escape. He was a bit of a slippery character, and he went to the US and resumed his counterfeiting activities. The law eventually caught up with him again, and he was sent to Alcatraz prison, where he even conned Al Capone.
Wow. It's said that he had a postcard of the Eiffel Tower taped onto his cell wall with the words, "Sold for 100,000 francs," written across it. Well, when Victor died in 1947, his death certificate read salesman as his occupation in tribute to his greatest scam.
That's nice. In 1960, then President Charles de Gaulle proposed temporarily dismantling the tower and sending it to Montreal for Expo 67. What a crazy idea. I mean, I like de Gaulle, but that's completely crazy. The plan was rejected, thank God, which must have made a lot of people breathe a sigh of relief. Imagine if they had lost one of the 18,000 metal parts or some of the 2.5 million rivets, or if they lost the plans for how it all goes together.
Oh my, can you imagine? I mean, it could have happened. It didn't, thank goodness. Anyway, if you've ever been up the tower in the wind and thought it was moving, you're probably right. Maximum sway at the top caused by the wind is around 12 centimetres, which is about 4¾ inches. Maximum sway at the top caused by metal dilation is up to 18 centimetres, 7 inches. I mean, you must feel it when you're up there, mustn't you? That's quite a big sway, really.
It is, it is. The Chamber of Commerce of Monza and Brianza in Italy valued the Eiffel Tower at 434 billion euros in August 2012. Must be much more by now. This apparently makes it Europe's most valuable commodity.
Today, the Eiffel Tower has takeaway food counters, two restaurants. One is on the first floor and one is on the second floor, called the Jules Verne, after the French writer of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Around the World in 80 Days. It's a very posh, very expensive restaurant, and it's loved by celebrities. You're likely to see people like Jennifer Aniston there, Rihanna, Mariah Carey, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Not together, of course. I'm not trying to start any rumours here. There's also a gift shop, a macaron bar, and a champagne bar. And at the top, you can visit a reconstruction of Gustave Eiffel's own apartment, which he used for meetings with VIPs and as a laboratory to study astronomy, meteorology, and aerodynamics. In 1909, he installed an aerodynamic wind tunnel at the base of the tower and used it for thousands of tests, including for the Wright brothers' airplanes and pusher cars.
Wow. And at night, and I love this, Madame Eiffel sparkles. 20,000 bulbs twinkle for 5 minutes on the hour. It's very lovely to see. And if you're up the tower when it sparkles, the second floor is the best place to be. And the tower brings out the romantic in some people. In fact, it's estimated that there are around 20 marriage proposals a day, between 7,000 and 10,000 marriage proposals every year up the Eiffel Tower or in the Trocadero, the area just down below. The tower is one of the top 10 places in the world for asking your loved one to marry you. Actually, there is even a woman who was married to the Eiffel Tower in a commitment ceremony in 2007, though they have since parted.
I remember reading about that in the paper, and it was Erica Eiffel.
Yeah, nice.
There's always one. Around 7 million people a year visit the tower, and that's how it's a record breaker. It is the world's most visited paid monument. I just wonder what Eiffel would say if he knew that more than 300 million people had now visited his tower.
Zut alors, that's what he would say, by Jove in French. And voilà, we hope you've enjoyed this Eiffel Tower episode. It's full of facts, as usual, but now it's time for our Q&A section. Got a question about France? Well, ask the experts. We reply to you in each episode. And we do it for free. You know it by now, in every episode of this podcast, we answer some of your questions, and we don't mind what you ask us. Let's find out what we have today, Janine.
Well, Ollie, we've had a question from a lady called Kim Bryant, who lives in Kentucky. She wants to know, I'm coming to France for the first time to spend Christmas in Paris, and I'm so excited. But what I want to know is it true that in France you don't tip the servers in restaurants? So, Ollie, over to you. Do we tip servers in restaurants in France?
Well, in France, service is included as part of the bill at restaurants and cafes. So, strictly speaking, it's not necessary to add a bit extra. However, it is a matter of personal choice, really, and you are free to do so. If you're paying by card and you want to tip, you just tell the server how much you'd like to add on.
I have to say, I usually do tip because it's such a custom in the UK where I'm from. So it just seems really normal to me. It's a habit. But I always do it with cash because it just seems so much more personal to give cash and say thank you. But I definitely don't tip if I'm not that impressed. Now, today we have two questions, actually, which is unusual. We normally have just time for one, but we have time for one more question. It's from Pastor David Knotts of Pennsylvania, who says, with Halloween just around the corner, how do you say boo in French? Ollie, how do you say boo in French?
Oh my God, that's a great question, David, but I need to think of the answer twice. You know, I'm so used to say boo being in the UK, but I believe it is ou, H-O-U. You say it to scare people, like ou, and to show disapproval too, but in a different way. Ooh, ooh, it's rubbish, ooh. I'm going to need French lessons, definitely, when I come back to France next year.
I have to say, Ollie, I do not think ooh is particularly scary. Mind you, nor is boo, but definitely boo is a bit more scary than ooh.
Yeah. But thanks so much for those questions, Kim and Pastor David. If you also have a question for us, feel free to send it to janine@thegoodlifefrance.com, janine@thegoodlifefrance.com, or via our podcast newsletter. This is the Good Life France podcast. Oh là là! Le podcast The Good Life France. And thank you again, a huge merci beaucoup to everyone for listening to our podcast from all around the world. And an enormous thank you for sharing the podcast with your friends and family. We are truly grateful when you do that. And before we go, I just want to say a huge congratulations on your new book, Janine. Yes, Janine has written a fourth book. It's called How to Be French, and it's a celebration of the French way of life, art de vivre, you know, gastronomy, fashion, and everything French. If you love France, you will love Janine's book.
Thank you very much, Ollie. That's very nice of you.
You're welcome. It's a great book. You absolutely need to read it. And you've been listening to Janine March and myself, Olivier Geoffrey. You can find me at parischanson.fr.
And you can find me and heaps of information about France, where to visit, culture, history, recipes, everything France at thegoodlifefrance.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast, my weekly newsletter about France, and our totally brilliant, totally free magazine at magazine.thegoodlifefrance.com. But for now, it's au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.
Speak to you soon.
The Good Life France podcast. Available on all podcast platforms. On thegoodlifefrance.com and on parischanson.fr. The most beautiful French songs of the 40s, 50s and 60s, only on Paris Chanson. Available on your mobile, smart TV, computer and smart speaker 24/7. Visit parischanson.fr to find out more. That's PARISCHANSON.FR.